And the court will proceed to the second case of the day, Yeftik versus Navistar. Mr. Sipes.
May it please the court. The district court erred when it dismissed count one of plaintiff's complaint for breach of contract for failure to state a claim. There are three issues presented by the briefs on appeal and before the district court. First, are the facts pled sufficient to demonstrate a breach of the contract? Second, are the facts pled sufficient to show that the union, the collective bargaining representative, breached its duty of good faith representation, of fair representation? And third, are they sufficient to excuse the workers, appellants here, from the requirement that they exhaust administrative remedies? In this case, the company laid these workers off and then subcontracted additional work out to others. As a result, the appellants filed not just a grievance, but repeated grievances.
Which ones of the appellants filed grievances?
All the appellants herein.
And you've alleged that in the complaint?
Yes.
I understand you're not the author of the complaint, but it was alleged in the complaint.
It was. In fact, page 5, paragraphs 32 to 37, filed numerous grievances about the subcontracting and the failure to recall. First, subcontracting out the work, and second, not recalling the workers when new and additional work became available. The complaint clearly states that those two actions violated the collective bargaining agreement. Defendants, company argues that there's no specific reference to a specific provision in the complaint or in the contract, yet they specifically allege the breach and what constituted the breach. They know what's in the contract. They couldn't get the contract from the union, an additional breach of their duties. So it was impossible for them to attach the contract and cite specific paragraphs, but they did cite the provisions that they believed were breached. The union took these complaints, these grievances, sat on them, lied to these workers and said, don't worry, these are being processed. They're now before high union officials. Until the plant was closed, the collective bargaining agreement was void and null. It was gone. There was no more collective bargaining agent. It would have been futile at that point for them to do anything. There was no remedy that could have been provided. The companies closed the plant. The locals out of business. What happened was the union managed to sit on those grievances, not muck up the works, reach whatever, as is pled, collusive purpose that may have been in play with the company, so that those grievances were never processed. The cases are cited in the briefs, but I'll add a couple. In Mitchell, 772 Fed Second 342, this court held that if the plaintiffs plead that the union breached its duty of fair representation in handling the grievances, that is sufficient to excuse them from exhausting administrative remedies. We would assert that the pleadings establish that the union took the grievances, didn't process them, and lied about it for motives which did not further the interests of their members. That is a sufficient basis to establish a breach of their duties. and then by alleging that the breach of the duties in handling those grievances subverted the grievance process, the plaintiffs have sufficiently pled facts which lead to excusing the administrative exhaustion doctrine.
The district court held that the allegations were really too conclusory to constitute the kind of factual content that's required to sustain a complaint after Twombly and Iqbal.
It did, Your Honor.
And they are contained in just a few paragraphs, the allegations with respect to the union's breach of duty of fair representation.
They are. On page 4, they're contained in 5 paragraphs. On page 5, in 5 paragraphs. On page 6, in 5 paragraphs. On page 7, 3. Now, that is a few paragraphs, but added up, those are fairly substantial factual pleading. On page 4, that the company subcontracted out the plaintiff's work, that they laid them off claiming that there wasn't any work there.
Right, that goes to the contract claim against the employer. I'm talking about the breach of the duty of fair representation by the union, which is a predicate to your 301 claim.
Certainly.
And those allegations are really contained in paragraph 35 to 38. And it consists of the allegation that there were hundreds of these grievances filed over the subcontracting outs contrary to the contract and the failure to rehire, and that the grievances weren't acted on and that your clients were misled about it. But there isn't anything of a specific factual nature that, on this date, this plaintiff was told fraudulently that his grievance was being processed. These are just general allegations. I think that was the district court's point.
That's correct, Your Honor. I would respectfully submit that when the pleadings say that the union intentionally misled the plaintiffs about the statuses of the grievances, polite way of saying they lied to them, and did so intentionally, that and there are a lot of words in here that, while factual, have legal import. Sometimes it's difficult to sort out whether that's some legal conclusion or a fact, but they diverted, they stalled, they terminated, they abandoned the grievances, all without rational purpose. They misled the plaintiffs, telling them that the grievances were awaiting actions by higher union officials, that they were never processed, that they were terminated, that the union was attempting, or knew that the company was attempting to evade their liability under the contract, and yet, instead of acting in good faith representing the plaintiffs, they acted in an arbitrary and perfunctory manner, intentionally designed to violate the plaintiff's rights under the contract.
That's the corporation you're talking about.
The union did those things knowing the company's purpose in attempting to evade the
breach. So did I understand it? When you say they misled in the pleadings, you're suggesting an improper intent. Is that the
suggesting and pleading specifically that
by the union?
Correct. The union
improper intent. So misleading. You mentioned lie before, but you want us to read improper intent, a malfeasance on the part of the union.
In fact, that's what's pled, Your Honor, that the union acted intentionally to violate the plaintiff's rights under the contract, knowing that the company intended to evade its responsibilities under that contract and breached it with the plaintiffs. And yet the union, for motives we don't know yet because discovery hasn't happened, we can all suggest what they may be in that circumstance, that the union lied to them in order for them not to do anything more to push those grievances and cause problems for the company, that they did it intentionally. And there are facts pled in, Your Honor's correct, on page 5 and 6, the paragraphs you mentioned, paragraph 47, some of those words like intentional, willful, and wanton, that they are factual, but they have legal import, that the union knew and intended that their actions would violate the plaintiff's rights. The union knew and intended to violate the plaintiff's rights. The union acted in bad faith in this circumstance, but more importantly, that is sufficiently pled in a 12B6 motion. This is...
No union official is named, though, right?
Correct, Your Honor. And as you know, in a hybrid action such as this, it is sufficient to plead the union's breach of its duty of fair representation to bring a contract action against the company.
All right. I want to reserve some time, Mr. Seifert.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Posey.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Thomas Posey, and I represent the defendant, Appelese. Your Honors, there's a theme that's emerged in this case, and the theme is allegations that don't appear anywhere in the complaint in support of an argument that there shouldn't have been a dismissal here. In the amended complaint, there's 65 numbered paragraphs. There's potentially three, that relate to or are factual allegations that could be argued to support this claim for a breach of the union's duty of fair representation. And, Your Honor, as you correctly pointed out, it's in the 30s here. It's 36 through 38 and then 53A. What those paragraphs say in total is you wouldn't give me or failed to give me a copy of my collective bargaining agreement. You lied to me about the status of my grievance and told me that it was in process, it was being worked on, it wasn't done yet. That's it.
There's more to it than that. They are allegations about lies and diversions and stall tactics and so forth, but also a factual allegation that, in fact, the grievances weren't processed at all. And why isn't that sufficient to suggest an arbitrary breach of the duty of fair representation?
Your Honor, because there's an extremely high bar, as you know, for even pleading this kind of a claim. It's very hard to get in front of a federal court with a breach of a duty of fair representation claim or with one of these hybrid claims.
That's the negotiation species of the claim. This is an administration species of the claim. We've drawn a distinction between the two. The standards that apply, it's not quite as deferential as you're suggesting when we're talking about a union's duty to process grievances. If that's the crux of the violation, which it is here, this is not a negotiations case.
That's true, Your Honor, but it is still very high. The conduct has to be egregious. It has to be so unreasonable that it rises to the level of irrational.
Well, why isn't it unreasonable and irrational and arbitrary to fail to process hundreds of grievances and then lie about it?
There's a couple reasons. One, what's alleged here at most shows perhaps that the union was lazy in processing these grievances. It doesn't show the collusive...
That sounds like a jury argument to me, or an argument to a fact finder, not a pleadings argument. We accept what the pleading says, and the pleading says that the union lied.
And
not,
Your Honor,
just that the union was lazy.
If any lie during the processing of a grievance constitutes a breach of the duty of fair representation, the court is in for a lot of hybrid Section 301 claims.
This is hundreds of grievances that were not processed, willfully not processed, according to the allegations in the complaint, and lies and other diversionary tactics were undertaken with respect to the employees over the course of a protracted period of time while the plant was being subcontracted, the work in the plant was being subcontracted out, allegedly in contravention of the contract.
Now, that's another difficulty with these allegations, though, here, Your Honor, is that, and even in the arguments this morning, there's a suggestion of this collusive purpose and that the union essentially took action to allow the company to close the plant. But there's two big problems with that. The biggest one, frankly, is what happened after the motion to dismiss proceedings here. In this case, there were two counts. The first count, which was dismissed and got us here today, was the 301 claim. The second was an ERISA interference claim. That one went through discovery, got all the way to summary judgment. The court granted it in the company's favor. During those proceedings, the plaintiffs affirmatively adopted as true and undisputed a number of facts asserted by the company. One of those facts was that the one and only reason that the plant closed was because the Ford Motor Company, which had a standing order for diesel engines, which were the only thing being produced in that plant, that order, the standing order for that those engines was pulled, and as a result, the plant closed. So, frankly, the plaintiffs, through the subsequent proceedings in this case, have already precluded themselves from even arguing that the union...
How does that affect the sufficiency of the complaint, which is all we have before us in this appeal?
Your Honor, the complaint at the time it was filed, that was in 2009. Since then, the plaintiffs have made affirmative statements and admissions that show that those allegations can no longer stand. So we would argue that, frankly, they can't rely on those allegations anymore because they've, after filing the complaint, said, well, actually, that part didn't happen, but we've got some other arguments. In addition to this duty of fair representation piece, though, there's several other bases for the dismissal of this claim. Those were all fully briefed before the district court, so those are all properly before Your Honors as other reasons to dismiss this claim. The biggest of those would be the failure to exhaust administrative remedies, the administrative process by the plaintiffs.
Well, how could they exhaust if they were being ignored? They filed hundreds of grievances. The grievances were being, at best, ignored, at worst, willfully obstructed by union officials. And so how could they be held to a duty to exhaust under those circumstances? The grievances weren't going anywhere.
And, Your Honor, under the cases addressing these issues, that's not enough. The only way that you get out of the exhaustion of your administrative remedies, the only excuses, are futility, repudiation of the grievance process by the employer, or a breach of the duty of fair representation by the union. So there's
A and C, futility and an alleged breach of the duty of fair representation. I mean, that's what these allegations go to.
And on the futility piece, there's two problems there. One is the mere fact that I filed my grievance and nothing happened for a while doesn't somehow excuse me from taking further action.
Nothing happened at all. The allegations are that the grievances were willfully obstructed and not acted upon by the union officials and, in fact, died.
And assuming that all those facts are true, if over the course of years, hundreds and hundreds of grievances were filed by these plaintiffs, that doesn't allow them just to put their feet up and wait a few years and see what happens. You have a duty to know your own rights under these contracts. What the plaintiff should have done, if someone filed a grievance and several years went by, the next thing that happens is you take it to the next step in the union. You have procedures that you can go through. You can, if nothing else, you go to whoever filed it and say, well, what's going on? What's next?
Well, the allegations are that they were being told upon inquiry that everything was fine, we're processing this. That's what the allegations in paragraph 38 are. The unions misled the plaintiffs by telling them that hundreds of grievances filed over a period of years await further action by high union officials, when in fact none have been processed and all are dead. So, I mean, the allegations are, and we have to accept at this stage that this is true, that they did make an effort to inquire about the status, and were told that they were in process. So why doesn't that forgive the exhaustion requirement?
Because the mere inquiry as to what's going on with my several years old grievance that supposedly nothing's happened with, again, if that's sufficient for a plaintiff to meet his or her duty to exhaust all their administrative remedies before coming to court, that can result in a flood of these claims coming in, because anyone who gets a response after sitting on their hands for years that, well, we're still working on it, that frankly excuses any grievance or plaintiff from having to do anything other than ask one time after submitting the grievance, well, whatever happened with that? The only other issue related to this exhaustion piece is the repudiation argument or these lies at the lower levels of the grievance process. A couple of the cases cited in our brief specifically say just because you have bias at the lower echelons of the grievance process, or even if there are misleading statements from the union that you rely on, that does not suffice to excuse you from the exhaustion of administrative remedies requirement. Now, as counsel argued earlier, that eventually it was too late and the plant closed. That doesn't in and of itself end the story. There is nothing that prevents, or it's not alleged anywhere in this complaint, that the closure of the plant prevented anyone from going up through the ranks in the union. These locals are part of the national union. That's the next step. And that whether the plant was still open, whether they'd even lost their jobs already, you still have a right to pursue these grievances further and say, well, wait a minute, I'm taking this to steps 2 through 8 of the appeals process.
All right, thank you for closing. Mr. Sipes. Mr. Sipes, what is your response to Mr. Posey's position that in the ERISA part of this, you've acknowledged the lack of collusion between the employer and the union officials?
The ERISA action in count 2 of plaintiff's complaint was based on the reason why the plant was closed and moved, not whether or not the union and the knew what the company was doing in violating the plaintiff's rights under the contract by not recalling them, nor about why the union may have done that. As I said, discovery may develop that motive. What has been pled is that the union had an improper motive. They acted arbitrarily.
Well, the improper motive that you're suggesting is that in collusion with the company, they were holding this pending the change in status of the company, right?
Not pled, Your Honor, but as an old country lawyer, the union trying to strike a deal with a company when they've got contracts with several plants around the country and wondering where that's going to be moved and whether or not there are going to be union jobs there that maybe can be saved by not fighting here. There are an awful lot of reasons why that might happen. We don't know what those reasons are. We only know the facts.
I appreciate that, and I take your argument. I'm just asking, is that apart from the position with regard to the ERISA action?
Frankly, Your Honor,
you don't know.
Count 2 is not here. I'm not here about count 2, and I really don't know the answer, but that also, I don't believe, is the issue before the court, and whether or not there's sufficiently pled facts to dismiss plaintiff's contract claim. Long before it ever got to questions about discovery and summary judgment on count 2, these allegations were never able to be tested. And with plaintiffs going forward on what was left of their case, whether or not there were things said and done with respect to what was left of that case that may in some way relate back to the original dismissal of this complaint, I don't know.
Was it available to the plaintiffs any evidence of what would be the normal grievance time frame? I mean, is there an allegation in here that was delayed? Did the plaintiffs have at their disposal? I mean, how do they know it's a delay, I guess? Is just because they knew grievances are normally handled in a shorter time frame?
Your Honor, at least one of these plaintiffs was, in fact, a shop steward who filed grievances, and the complaint alleges up until the day of the filing of the complaint. And that's almost true. He filed repeatedly over and over. Some of these grievances weren't years old. They were weeks old, and nothing was happening. So there is some knowledge within the group of plaintiffs about the normal course of how grievances are processed. But there is no pleading before the court on that question.
The ERISA claim is premised on the plant closure, or was premised on the plant closure, correct?
Correct.
And the 301 claim is premised on the subcontracting out and the failure to recall.
Correct.
Distinct from the closure of the plant.
Distinct. The only element of the closure that comes into the ERISA claim is based on this court's holding in Bassett, 773 Fed Second 932. It became futile when the union could no longer provide the plaintiffs with the remedy they sought, even had the grievance process gone forward, because one of the things they sought was reinstatement and jobs were gone. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sedge. Thanks to both counsel.